to talk about asymptotic freeness of random matrices. So in the first lecture, Jamie motivated the notion of freeness essentially by showing that Gaussian random matrices are becoming asymptotically free. And then I showed you how you also get this notion of freeness in the context of random matrices, and we try to understand it a little bit better. But today I want to come back to these random matrices, because this connection between freeness and random matrices is one of the most important results and most fruitful results in free probability theory. So I want to say a little bit more about this. Okay, so the lecture today will be about asymptotic freeness of random matrices. And let me recall what we essentially saw in the first lecture. So the first thing we saw was this Wigner semicircle. So what happens if I have one Gaussian random matrix? And in the notation which I introduced last time, so we can say that a Gaussian random matrix converges to a semicircular element. So An is a Gaussian M by N random matrix. A self-adjoint matrix where the entries are independent apart from the symmetry condition and have all normal distribution normalized by variance 1 over n, and S is a semicircular element. And this was essentially defined by saying that its moments are given by the Catalan numbers. Okay, and the statement here just means that the moment of this guy with respect to the expectation and the trace converts to the Catalan numbers. Good. Okay, that's more or less the classical theorem of Wigner, but then one of the main observations is that you can make an extension of this to several Gaussian random matrices, and that's actually where you observe the notion of freeness. So if instead of one Gaussian random matrix, you consider several of them, let's say P, AN1 up to ANP, then what Jamie showed you in the first lecture is that they are asymptotically free. Those guys here are P, Gaussian random matrices, and the relation between them is that they are independent. So these are P independent Gaussian random matrices. Okay, and this statement, to say it in another way, by using this notion of convergence in distribution, we can also say that AN1 up to ANP converges to a free family of semicircular elements. So they converge to S1 up to SP, where each S is a semicircular element, and they are free. So these are three semicircular elements. And how did we show this? Again, by looking at the moments, on all mixed moments of those guy, and identifying what they are in the limit, and then seeing that they are exactly the moments of these things. Also, this was shown by looking on all mixed moments in the limit, so the limit n goes to infinity of the moment, and the moments are the expectation of the trace, and then any word in the A's, an I1 up to an IM. Okay, and identifying this limit as the same as the corresponding moment of our element S, SI1 up to SIM. Okay, now those are free semicircular elements. Okay, and being free and semicircular means exactly that you get the moments which Jamie showed you in the limit. Of course, when he did it, he didn't really have this notion. He essentially just calculated what is this limit in combinatorial terms. Okay, but now that we have our combinatorial machinery for freeness, we can of course say what it means, what is the moment, such a moment of free semicirculars. So what does it mean that S1 up to SP are free semicirculars? So what does it mean in terms of cumulants? I introduced 2 weeks ago the notion of cumulants, and the idea was that we should write our moments in terms of cumulants by summing over non-crossing partitions. And so what does it mean to be a semicircular? A semicircular means that only the second cumulant is different from zero. So actually you're only summing over pairings, not over all partitions. And free means that mixed cumulants vanish. So this means that actually all the cumulants in this whole family here only consists of second second order cumulants, and then the S's must be the same. Oh, okay, so the free means that mixed cumulants vanish, and semicircular means that we only have second order cumulants. Oh, okay, so this means if I'm looking at a cumulant Km of Si1 up to Sim, this is 0 if m is not equal to 2, so this means actually I'm only summing over pairs in the end, so m must be 2, but then in addition the two S's must be the same. So that's really what we are saying, what we can say, we have to respect the color. Huh? So we think of S1 and S2 having different colors, so our pairings must really connect the same color. That was exactly the way as Jamie formulated in the first lecture, how to get how to describe the limit of these moments. Okay, so we also need that I1 and I2 have to be the same. Okay, and then with this, I mean, for this, by using the moment cumulant formula, we get exactly the expression as we observed in the first lecture for this one. So we get that phi Si1 up to Sim is the sum. A priori we have to sum over all partitions, but because the cumulants are only different from 0 if I have blocks of length 2, this means I'm only summing over partitions which only have blocks of length 2, which means I'm only summing over pairings. So I'm only summing over non-crossing pairings of m elements, and for this I get a contribution kappa pi of Si1 up to Sim. Okay, and we know what this is. So essentially this tells us that the pairing by this must connect the same color. Okay, so we're summing over all non-crossing pairings, but we have the additional constraint coming from this that I only connect S1 with S1, S2 with S2, but I'm not mixing terms. Okay, or we can say that pi must respect the colors. Okay, good. So that was what we observed in the first lecture. So we and then of course, I mean, if you have this formula, then I mean you can rearrange this that you really see that you have asymptotic freeness. Okay, but I mean by really going down to the definition of freeness. Okay, but I mean now we have enough machinery so really to see that we have this formula, I mean we know that this is the same as having freeness. Okay. So I mean it's in a sense that was really the first step what Jamie did. But because he didn't have really a theory of freeness at this moment, he had to go to the definition of freeness to really show that you have this notion. But if you have enough information about how to calculate mixed moments of free random variables, then of course it's enough to see that in a limit you have exactly the calculation rule for those guys. Good. Okay, so the statements about this asymptotic freeness are, in the way as we treated it here, is respect to the average trace. Oh, okay, so we take the trace and then we average over our ensemble, but I want to point out that, I mean, all these statements are usually also true if you only look on the traces, and then you have also the convergence almost purely. Oh, okay, so I mean, usually we are only dealing with taking the expectation, but I mean, in a sense, it's quite nice and maybe more impressive for random matrices that things happen even almost purely. Okay, so, and I mean, maybe I want to show you a few pictures on this before we go on. I mean, our goal will be to see more asymptotic freeness among random matrices, to have more general situations, but maybe let me first show you what we know from the first lecture. I should go down the screen. On random matrices, and maybe also make clear this distinction between convergence on average and almost pure convergence. Good. Okay, so this shows the convergence of the average eigenvalue distribution of n by n Gaussian random matrices. Well, so this is somehow the first step. If I have only one and I'm looking on the eigenvalue distribution, then this should converge to the semicircle. And of course, I mean, the distribution which has the Catalan numbers as its moment is the semicircle. So it's really a statement about this convergence. And so if you see for n equal to 50, it's quite close. But what I'm doing here, I'm averaging over my ensemble. So I'm generating my Gaussian random matrices very often, and I just average over them. So I realize here 10,000 Gaussian 50 by 50 random matrices. I take this 10,000 times 50 eigenvalues, and I draw the histogram of them. And I mean, they should be close to the semicircle. That's what this statement is about. Okay, but then, as I said, actually the situation is in a sense much better. I mean, of course, to prove this, you have to prove something more. I don't want to do this, but actually you have almost sure convergence. So this means if you just look on one random matrix, I mean, you should look on a sequence of n by n matrices where n increases, then actually you can be almost sure that you also go converge to the semicircle. So here I have three realizations of n by n matrices where you increase n, and in each case you converge to the semicircle in the limit. Okay, so, but of course, I mean, you need a much bigger n to be close to the semicircle in this case, that's clear. Okay, so that's somehow the almost pure version, that if you should just generate one big random matrix, you can be quite sure that you're also close to the semicircle. Okay, but then we also, this asymptotic freeness, what does this tell us? I mean, this is saying, if I have now two Gaussian random matrices, let's say I call them A and B in this case, then we are saying in distribution they converge to two free semicirculars, S1 and S2. Okay, so this means, of course, that if I take any mixed word, for example, this moment here in the A's and the B's, it should converge to the limit to the corresponding word moment of the S's, and we know, I mean, how to calculate them. We have to count the non-crossing pairings which respect the color. Okay, so in this example, I mean, the S's are red, and the S1 is red, and S2 is blue, and I'm looking for non-crossing pairings which connect S1 with S1 and S2 with S2, and there are just two of them. Okay, so this means this limit is 2. Okay, and of course this means if I'm taking random matrices and I calculate this quantity, I mean I should converge to 2. That's exactly the statement which this asymptotic freeness helps me here. And again, I mean, essentially we proved this in the averaged version, so which means if I'm, so here I take for each n, I take 1,000 n by n random matrices, calculate, I generate independently one and another one, and then I look on the trace of this mixed word, and I plot it here, so for each n, so this is 15, 20, 25, up to 30, I average over 1,000 realizations, and you see, I mean, here's 2. So I have quite fast convergence to 2. But again, the same statement is true in almost sure sense. So if you only do one realization, of course, then n should again be bigger, but again, I mean, you have a convergence to this. So in this case, for each n, I only have taken one realization of my two independent Gaussian random matrices and calculated this word in it. Okay, so one for each n, and again, you see I have a convergence to 2. No, I mean there will be a curve, I mean which somehow you can calculate, but which we didn't. There should be some kind of smooth curve, and I mean of course you should see this here. I mean of course for finite n the answer is not 2. It's something which is close to 2, which you can calculate if you want. But I mean the statement is if n goes to infinity, then we are converging to 2. So even if you are averaging, you never will get 2 for finite n. Maybe I just want to show you some other random matrices. I mean, of course, the point is there are much more random matrices ensembles around. And I mean, if you just would be able to deal with Gaussian ones, this wouldn't really be too exciting. But I mean, there are much more around. And for example, another example are the Wishart random matrices, where we take X is a n times m, so it can be a rectangular, not necessarily square random matrix, and it has independent entries without any symmetry assumption, and then we are looking on x times x star. Okay, and again, we have the same phenomena here, that if n goes to infinity in such a way that the ratio of m and n remains fixed, then we again converge in average, but also in almost pure sense, to a limit distribution. Okay, and this limit distribution is Marchenko-Pasteur distribution. So it's called Marchenko-Pasteur, and of course it depends on the ratio of n and m. Again, here I have two different realizations for 2000 by 8000 matrix X, and then I take X times X star, which is I suppose a 2000 by 2000 matrix, and then I'm plotting the 2000 eigenvalues. Okay, and here I mean the same for a different ratio, 3000 by 6000. Okay, and I mean, so the point is whether we can also maybe understand such things or even more complicated questions for maybe the sum or some other quantities of random matrices. Good. Okay, so so what I want to do now is first of all to switch this off and then talk about more general situations where I have freeness for random matrices. Okay, but I mean, we want to imitate what we have seen here. So in order to see that we have freeness, we have to recognize that in the limit, we will calculate moments in the limit, and then we should see that this is a situation as it occurs for free random variables. So this means we should have a good enough understanding of moments of free random variables. I mean, here we only needed it for free semicirculars, which are quite simple because we know them. Okay, but if we want to have more general situations, we should understand more general moments in the limit. Okay, so before I'm talking about random matrices, we should talk about such moments, and what I in particular want to consider are the products of free variables. Good. Okay, so the situation is the following. I have two sets of variables, A's and B's, and I assume that the A's are free from the B's. So let's say I have A1 up to AR, which is free from the B1 up to BR. So this means the algebra generated by those is free from the algebra generated by those. So the A's among themselves are not free, not necessarily free, and the B's among themselves are not free. It's just this algebra is free from this algebra. And what I want to consider is a mixed moment where I alternatingly multiply A with B. Okay, so A1, B1, A2, B2, up to AR, BR. And I mean, the A's could be the same. This could all be the same A's and the same B's, or I could repeat them. So I mean, I really have here somehow the most general alternating word in free random variables. And the question is, what can we say about this? Do we see any structure in this? And of course, by using our cumulant machinery, we know a priori how to calculate this guy. Namely, we should sum over the cumulants. So we should sum over non-Gaussian partitions of as many vectors as we have here, which are 2R. And we take kappa pi of A1, B1, A2, B2, up to AR, BR. And just recall, I mean, this k pi was just this notation for denoting a product of cumulants for one cumulant, one factor for each block of the pi. And that the arguments are given by the elements which are connected by this block. Good. Okay, so this is just general theory without using that the A's and the B's are free. But now if we use the information that the A's and the B's are free, then we know that mixed cumulants vanish, so the blocks which appear for the pi are not allowed to connect an A with a B. Otherwise, the contribution is zero. So actually, we are only summing over pi's for which we have some blocks which connect only A's within themselves, and we have other blocks which connect the B's, but we don't have blocks which connect A's with B's. So this means that the pi is actually a union of blocks for the A's and a union of blocks for the B's. And of course, I mean, the blocks for the A's make a non-crossing partition of the A's, and the blocks for the B's make a non-crossing partition of the B's. But of course, they are somehow interlaced, so that they together are also a non-crossing partition. Good. So this means I can write this here as sum over pi with pb and nc of 2R. And then, of course, this is a product according to the blocks. So if I collect the blocks corresponding to pi A, then, of course, I will get the corresponding quantity for the pi A and the same for the pi B. So what I have here is actually a product of kappa pi A, just of the A's, A1 up to AR, times kappa pi B of B1 up to BR. Okay. Because, I mean, this just factorizes into some terms which only corresponds to the A's. I collect them here, and some terms which only corresponds to the B's. Good. Okay. But now, so I have essentially a double sum, because I'm summing over the PAs and the PBs. Okay, so just let us do one of them first, and then see what restriction we have on the other sum. So let me write this as the sum over, let's say, PA in NC of R, kappa PA of A1 up to AR times, and now I have to sum, okay, this doesn't depend on pi B, so I have now to sum over pi B, which is a non-crossing partition of the B's, but of course, so that if I take it together with the pi A, it must also be non-crossing. So kappa pi B of B1 up to BR. Okay, another question is, I mean, can we understand this set about which we are summing? And I'm claiming, actually, this is a quite nice set, because essentially we are summing over pi B, which are smaller than some special element. So I'm saying there's a biggest pi B which fulfills this condition, and what we are summing about are all the ones which are smaller. Okay, and I mean this biggest one is what we are calling the complement of pi A. So I'm saying here that this means I have to sum over all pi B's which are smaller than the complement of pi A. Okay, what do I mean with this? And let us look on the sample. So I mean I have somehow the situation as A B, A B, A B, A B, let's say, and I'm fixing a non-crossing partition for the A's. Huh? So let's say, for example, this one. So this is my partition for the A's, and then I have to sum over all partitions for the B's, non-crossing partitions of the B's, but if I take it together with this partition of the A's, it should be still non-crossing. And of course this means I should, the biggest one which I can make in the B's is to connect as many B's as possible without getting crossings with the blocks of the A's. So I mean, of course, I mean, I can connect here, and I can connect here. And if I connect less in the B's, then of course it's also still okay. Okay, so the biggest one, which means just connect as much as possible, and then anything which is smaller is also okay. So this means the possibilities for the pi B's which I have are exactly the ones which are smaller than this biggest one. And this biggest one is what we call the complement. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, so we are saying all those are allowed. So in this case, I mean here, I mean this here with our pi A, and I mean this here is the complement, so K, it was introduced by Quiveras, so K stands either for the German word of complement or for Quiveras. So it's kappa, it's K of pi A. And the pi B's, which are allowed here, are all the ones which are smaller than this one. Okay, and so I mean in this case the complement of this partition of this one, of the one for the A's, is the partition for the B. So this is this partition. Good. Okay, so this means I can continue the sum as above by saying I'm summing over pi in NC of R of kappa pi A1 up to AR, and then I'm summing the cumulants over all pi B which are smaller than a given partition, maybe the complement of pi. So I'm now changing, because I only have one pi in the end, so I'm just using pi instead of pi A. but if I'm summing over cumulants, I get the moments. Okay, so if I'm summing over all partitions, then I get the moment. And if I'm summing the cumulants, which are smaller than a given partition, this means essentially that I'm summing over everything, for each block I'm summing over things which are smaller, which means I get, for each block I get the corresponding moment. So I get the product of the corresponding moments. So what I get here is phi of the complement of k pi of b1 up to br. Well, I mean, this notation phi b has the same meaning as it has for the cup bath, namely it's a product of phi, one for each block of this partition here. Okay, so what I'm using here is that if I'm summing over cumulants, I get moments. And I get the moments somehow corresponding to these upper limits in my sum. Okay, so you see, I mean, I have in my moment cumulant formula, I have done a partial summation, so I have replaced part of the cumulants by the moment, and I have expressed the moments of my mixed word, my alternating word in A and B's, in terms of the cumulants of the A's and the moments of the B's. Okay, and I mean that's a type of formula which we would like to see in the limit of random matrices. Okay, and then maybe let me just make an example to make the structure of this formula clear. So for example, in the simplest case, if I have phi of A1 times B1, so what does this formula tell me? Of course, we know how to calculate. It's this factorizes like phi of A1 times phi of B1, but how do we do it with this formula? This formula tells me I should sum over the partitions of the A. There's only one of them. And what is the complement? Of course, the complement, there's also this one-point partition. So this means I should take the cumulant of the A's corresponding to this. So this is kappa 1 of A1. And then I should take the moment of the B's corresponding to this partition, which is phi of B1. And because K1 is equal to phi, of course, this is just a factorization rule. Okay. Maybe more interesting example. Let us take A1, B1, A2, B2. Again, we know how to write it in terms of phi, but we want to see how it works with this formula. So what should I do? I should sum over the non-crossing partition of the A's, and there are two of them. And in each case, I should look for the complement in terms of the B's. I mean, here, the B's, I cannot connect them because the A block prevents this, but in this case, I mean, I can connect it. So what I get here, the contribution, I have the cumulant for the A, so I have kappa 2 of A1, A2, and I multiply it with the moment of the B's corresponding to this partition. So this is this moment times this moment, so this is phi of B1 times phi of B2. And in the second case, I have the kappa 1 of A1 times kappa 1 of A2, and I get the moment in the B's, where B1 and B2 are connected, so this is phi of B1 times B2. Okay, and of course, if you plug in what kappa 1 and kappa 2 is, I mean, you can express this totally in terms of phi, and we get the formula which we know. Okay, but I mean, this is somehow a formula which we chose more structure. So if you try to express the moment of A times B in terms of the moment of A and the moment of B, the formulas are quite complicated, because they contain explicitly a Möbius function somewhere. And Möbius functions are complicated, a lot of signs and numbers which are not so easy to control. But if you do it in a mixed way, if you express the moment of A times B in terms of the cumulant of one of them and the moment of the other, then the formulas are much nicer, because you're just summing over non-crossing partition without any signs and any Möbius functions. Good. Okay, and of course, I mean, this looks a little bit unsymmetric, so why should I take the cumulant of A and the moment of B? Of course, I can also do it the other way around. And then I get essentially the same type of formula. The only difference is that instead of the complement, I should take the inverse of the complement. Because, I mean, the A's are coming before the B's, so there's some order involved. And I mean, of course, I have to if I'm defining the complement, I'm saying that I take the complement for the B's, which are coming after the A's. So if I exchange the row of the A's and the B's, then of course, I mean, what I'm looking in the A's is the inverse of the complement. Okay, but nevertheless, it's the same structure of the formula. So in the same way, we can also say A1, B1, A2, B2, up to AR, BR is the sum over non-crossing partitions of R elements. And I take the moment of the A's, but the moment of the inverse of the complement of pi A1 up to AR times kappa pi B1 up to BR. Okay, good. And I mean, and I should know that, of course, I mean, the complement is not an involution. So, I mean, if it's not the inverse of the complement, is not the complement itself. It's because it's this unsymmetry. I mean, I have to say, if I do the complement, then the B's are coming after the A's. Of course, I could do the other way around. But if I fix this, then the complement, of course, does it the other way around. So this means if I'm doing the complement twice, I'm not coming back to from where I started, but I'm not too far away. What I have done is just a shift of of my partition. Also, for example, okay, so maybe one should know this. So I mean, the inverse of the complement is not the inverse, or to say it another way, the complement squared is not the identity, but it's not too far away, and it's just a shift by minus one. So I'm shifting all my points. So for example, if I'm looking at the complement of this guy, okay, so let us see what this is. So I have this one. For the complement, I'm putting my extra points, the b's, I'm putting them here. What is the complement? It's this one. It's this one. So the complement of this is this one. Okay, and what is now the complement of this? And I'm doing it again. So I have now this. So I mean my new points, the b's, are here, and I'm looking, what can I connect? I can connect this. So this is this one. I mean, that's not from what I started, but I mean that is from what I started if you read it starting from here in a cyclic way. So if you say this is 1, 2, 3, then this is, so it's really just this shift of this partition just by 1 or minus 1. Good. So I think that's what I wanted to say about the structure of the formulas of products. And I mean, now I want to switch over to random matrices, and I want to see that in the limit of special types of random matrices, I exactly get such formulas. And of course, you see that those formulas, I mean, they involve the cumulants of one random variable at the moment of the others, so those formulas are in particular nice if one of the random variables has nice cumulants, as it is, for example, the case for semicirculars. Because, I mean, then I know exactly what the cumulants are, and like this formula gets even nicer. Good. Okay. So I want to look now on a situation where I still have 1,000 random matrices, which in limit get semicirculars, but I also have something else. So up to now we only considered the relation between 1,000 random matrices. I might have several of them, and they are getting free in the limit, but each of them is a semicircle, which is of course very special. So I see freeness for very special distributions. Okay, but I want to generalize this and. Yeah. Let me see. I can do this by including some additional type of matrices in my consideration, and those are non-random matrices, or we're also calling them constant matrices. But this means they are not really random matrices, but are just matrices which are deterministic and which have, of course, a limit distribution. So the main part of my talk is about asymptotic freeness between Gaussian random matrices and constant or non-random matrices. So the situation which I consider is that I have, let's just only consider one of each of them. Of course, I could take more, but let's say I have one Gaussian random matrix and I have one constant matrix. So we consider An, our Gaussian M by N random matrix. And in addition, I also consider Dn. So this is a random matrix, but which is not really random, but it's constant as a random variable. Okay, so it's a constant matrix, just n by n matrix, which is non-random. But of course, we have to assume that if n goes to infinity, I mean, actually, we are not looking on one of them, but we are looking on a sequence for each n. And of course, we have to assume that in the limit. The eigenvalue distribution in the limit exists, or in our language that all choices of powers exist. So we assume the existence of limit eigenvalue distribution of Dn. So this means we have, we can say abstractly that Dn converges in distribution to some element P. And I mean, what is, how do we calculate the distribution? Of course, we're looking on traces of powers of this guy. We should also take the expectation, but I mean, because D is constant, I mean, we don't, I mean, it doesn't depend on the probability space, so it's, we don't need the expectation, so this just means that the traces of powers of Dn should converge to something. And this something, I mean, we say this is given by an abstract element D, which has exactly this limit, guys, as moments. So what we are really, really assuming here is that the limit of the normalized traces of the n power of our matrix Dn exists for each m. Okay, and I mean that this limit is what we are calling phi of d to the m. Okay, so just to say that we have a limit element. Good, so the situation is that we have An converges to a semicircular element, and then we have in addition this sequence of constant matrices which converge to some element D, so which means it has a limit distribution. But the question is, can we also say something about the behavior between S and D, or the behavior between the A's and D's? Okay, so could we really hope, of course, I mean, we are hoping for freeness between them. So can we hope, does it make sense to hope to have freeness between them? And I mean, I'm not making any assumptions about D. For example, D's could be diagonal matrices. Okay, so can it be true that if I have diagonal matrices which converge to something in a limit, that they are free from Gaussian random matrices? Okay. So, and I mean, good, so let us try to see it. So what we should do is we should calculate all possible mixed moments in the A's and the D's, and we have to see whether we recognize the structure which we get in the limit. Okay, and I mean, it's very similar to the calculation which Jamie did in the first lecture. I mean, he only did it for the A's. Okay, but now we are going to include additional constant matrices. But the main ideas are really, I mean, ideas which depend on properties of the A's. Good. Okay, but so let us see what we get. So what we need to calculate is the limit n going to infinity, the expectation of the trace of any mixed word in the D's and the A's. And I mean, the D's are just some constant matrices. So I mean, if I take a power of the D, this is more or less of the same type. Whereas for my Gaussian random matrices, of course, I know very well how to deal with a Gaussian random matrix. But if I take a power, of course, this is another element. So I'm writing powers of A really as A times A times A, whereas powers of the D's are just some other D's. So it doesn't. So I really can write things in a sense as alternating product in A's and something in the D's. And if I allow powers for the D's, including power zero, I don't need powers for the A. The point is that really I want the A's to really be the Gaussian random matrices. So what I really want to look at is a power Q1 of D times A, then another power of the D, and so on. So alternatingly an A and some power of the D. D of Qm, An. Yeah, and the question is, can we deal with this in the limit? And we want this for all powers of the Q's, where we also allow the power zero, which means that that A's are coming together and we have actually also powers of the A's. Okay, good, so we have to understand this for all M Q1 Qm, where explicitly we allow that Q of K is also equal to zero. And of course the point is, writing it like this, is that I have alternatingly the D's and the A's, and I mean that's exactly the situation which I told you about before. Okay, so if we are expecting, hoping for freeness here, we should see somehow that we get the formulas which I showed you before for free variables. Good. Okay, so now, yeah, let us deal with this. Of course, again, we go over, we write these guys here in terms of the entries of our matrices, and, of course, using the fact that we know quite well the joint distribution of the entries of our Gaussian random matrices. So let me write First of all, I will suppress this M in the following. Yeah, I mean, it's understood that all our matrices are N by N matrices and depend on N, and in the end, N will go to infinity, but of course the formulas are getting a bit heavy if I put the N everywhere. So I'm not going to write it in the following. Okay, so and the entries of D to the power Q, I will write as Dij, the super index Q. So this is our N by N matrix, and dA, the entries of dA, I will denote by Aij. Okay, let me recall what we know about the A's. I mean, what is our assumption? These are Gaussian random matrices, so this means the entries are independent apart from the symmetry condition, and they are really normal Gaussian random variables, and for this we are going to use the Wick formula. So what we will have are products of elements from this Gaussian family, and the Wick formula, which Jimmy showed you in the first lecture, is that I can express any mixed moment in such A's by summing over pairings and reducing it to the second moment. So the Wick formula for classical Gaussian random variables, which is the main ingredient in this calculation, is that if I take any expectation of A of I1, J1, of any product of matrix entries of my Gaussian random matrix, I2, J2, up to A, IM, JM, that this is given by summing over non-crossing, over all pairings, in a classical context, over all pairings, and then I have to to multiply the variance of the elements, or the covariance of the elements which are coupled by those pairings. So for each block of my pairing, so let's say a block consists of the elements R and S, so I take the product over all blocks, and each block gives the contribution where I take the covariance of the two elements which are coupled by this block. Also, this means that the element at the position R is coupled with the element at the position S. So I have here A, I, R, J, R, times A, I, S, J, S. Good, so this is the reduction of all moments to the second moment, and then of course we know the second moment, because I mean essentially everything is independent with the exception of if I have the symmetry, which means if this one is the is this one in the reverse order. So we also know that if I have the entry at the position ij and the entry at the position kl, then they can only be the same if J is equal to K and I is equal to L. Because then this is the adjoint of this, and I get something, and we normalize it to be 1 over N. So in most cases it is 0. So what I need is that I is equal to L and J is K equal to K, otherwise it is 0. But if those are the same, then this is the adjoint of this, so it is something, and then I have to normalize the variance somehow, and we did this by 1 over N. Because that's the right normalization to get something in the limit. Good. Okay, so that's just another way of showing that we have Gaussian random matrices. By really saying what is the joint distribution of the entries. Because that's really what we need. Huh? If you're going to calculate this, writing it down in terms of the entries, that's exactly the information that we need. Good. Okay, so let us now try to do this calculation. So we should write down this mixed moment in the D's and the A's in terms of the entries, and then go ahead. Okay, maybe I should have left this here. Okay, so what do we want to calculate? It's the expectation of the trace of a product of D, Q1, A, and so on, D to the power Qm times A. So first we write this in terms of the entries and the trace. So this is a normalized trace. So we are getting a factor 1 over n from the normalization. Okay, and then we are summing Okay, overall, all yeah, products of the entries of those guys where the indices have to fit in the usual way as for matrix multiplication and because of the trace also in a cyclic way. So I mean, maybe the main point here is to choose the indices in such a way that in the end the formulas are not too complicated. So let me do it in the following way. So I have Q1 and I'm calling the index here J1, I1. So I need actually, because I have 2m variables, I need 2m indices, and some of them I'm calling J, others I'm calling I, because this will come out nicely in the end. So I have the B, then I have the A, I1, J2, then I have a B, Q2 here of J2, I2, AI2, I3, and so on, up to D of JM, IM, at the position QM, AIM, and then in a cyclic way, it should be the first one, J1. So this is the last A. And I'm summing over, so I have I1 up to IM, and I have J1 up to JM, and they are my indices, all of them running from 1 to N. Okay, so I mean this index is the same as this, this is the same as this, and so on. So it's for matrix multiplication, and the last one is the same as the first one, because I have the trace. Okay, and otherwise all the indices should be different, and I just have made a special choice how I call them. Some of them are J, and some are I. So you see, I mean, I have here essentially at the A I have the I's, I2 and I3, and at the D's I have, okay, a mixture of J and I. Good, so now I have here the expectation. But of course the D's are constant, so the expectation doesn't affect the D's. It only acts on the A's, so I can separate this in the product of the A's, where I have to act with the expectation, and then I'm left with the product of the D's. Good, so let me write it this way. So it's 1 over N. I have the sum over my I and J indices, and then I have the expectation of the A's, so I'm just collecting the terms of the A. The A terms, so it's A of I1, let me see, what is it, I1, J2, I1, J2, A of I2, J, J3, A of plus 1 is IM, J1. Okay, and then I'm left with the D's, which is D of J1, I1, and so on, up to D of JM, IM, QM. So you see the structure of the indices in D is quite simple. It's a J at some position, at this position, and the I at this position. For the A, it's more complicated. I mean, I have two choices. I mean, if one is simple, the other is complicated, it's not so straightforward. It's I at the position and J at the next position. Good, anyhow. But now, I can apply my Wick formula. So this is now the expectation of a product of entries in my Gaussian random matrix. For this, I have my Wick formula, which tells me that this is the sum over all pairings of M elements. I have here M terms, M factors. And, yeah, what is the contribution of such a pairing? I have to multiply its blocks. So let's say I have a block which connects the position R with the position S. I mean, this is really connecting the positions here. And then I have to take the covariance of the two elements at this position. So I have to take the element at the position R. But what are the indices at the position R? I mean, it's I of this position and it's J of the next one. So it's I of R times J of R plus 1. And the element at the S, at position S, is A of IS, J of S plus 1. Okay. So that's the Wick formula. Just coupling the elements according to the block structure of pi. And now, in addition, I use the fact that I know what is the covariance of two elements, so I need somehow that they must be symmetric to each other, which means this here gives me delta contribution, so this index must be this index, and this must be this one, otherwise it is zero. So what I get here, if it is not zero, I get a factor 1 over n. So this guy here is delta of IR, so IR must be the same as J of S plus 1, and J of R plus 1 must be the same as IS. Good, so let us see what we have got up to now. Okay, and this factor 1 over n, in case they are different, it's not zero. Okay, so what have I got up to now? So maybe let us collect the factors 1 over n. So we have 1 over n from here, and then here for each block of pi, we get a 1 over n. So we have pairings of m numbers, which means we have m over 2 blocks. So we have here 1 plus m over 2. Then we are summing, and now, okay, we do the usual trick. I mean, I exchange the sum of the indices and the pi's. So I'm summing first over the pairs, over the pi's, and then I'm summing over the i's and the j's. And then, yeah, what do I have here? I have the product over all blocks, but now you see, what I have here is exactly the condition, it's essentially the same condition twice for each of the elements of my block. It's saying that I, at one element in the block, must be j of plus one of the other element in the block. And if I'm identifying a pairing with a permutation, then I mean this is exactly the same condition for the application of my permutation on both elements. So as Jimmy did in the first lecture, it's good in this context to identify a pairing actually with a permutation by saying a block is just a transposition, sending one element in the block to the other element. So identifying pi is a product of transpositions. So then I can identify pi with something in a symmetric group. And you see I'm adding here plus 1. So if I also write this in terms of permutations, this is just a cyclic a permutation which just shifts everything by 1. So it adds 1. But of course, I mean, if S is the last one, I always have to think about this in a cyclic way, modulo M. So it's really the cyclic permutation. Okay, let me denote this by gamma. So this is the cycle, which stands 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and so on, and M to 1. And then actually I can write this here, this product here, instead of running over the blocks, I'm now just running over all numbers from 1 to n, and I have this condition that I of r must be the same as j of pi of r of the next element, and then shifted by 1, but shifted by 1 is just the application of gamma. So I write this in a more formal way as j of gamma times pi of r. Oh, okay, so I at the position r must be the same as j at the position gamma of pi of r. That's the same as the one which I had before. Okay, and then I'm still left with the b's. So I have b of, say, 1, I1, up to d of jn, in, to the power of qn. And now, of course, I mean, we see that this data give us some conditions on the I and the j. So actually, instead of summing over all I and j's, we are only summing over those which fulfill this condition. So this means if I'm fixing one of them, if I'm having the j's, then this tells me what the I must be. This gives me a condition on the I. So the i's are really not independent summation indices, but they are fixed by the j's. Okay, so this means the sum here is actually only a sum over j's. So I have to plug in this value for the I at the positions where they appear. So what I have is 1 over n, 1 plus m over 2, sum over pi in pairings of m elements, and then I'm just left with summing over j. So j's, I have m of them, j1 up to jn, running from 1 up to n. And what do I have here? I have d of j1, but the i1 must be the j of gamma of pi of 1, and so on. And the last one, I have j of m, and the I of m must be j, but at the position gamma of pi of m. Okay, so now it only remains to see what is actually this sum. I mean, the quantity which we know about these are traces of powers of them. So the only hope is that this summation here is actually something in traces of powers, maybe a product of traces. And that's actually the case. Really what I have here is nothing else than a product of traces, essentially along the cycles of this permutation here. Okay, so let me write it down, but then I want to make this clear with an example. So this here is actually a product of traces along the cycles of this permutation which shows up here, gamma pi. Well, it's not pi itself which is important, but it's gamma pi. But that was the same as we had it in the first lecture. Okay, maybe, yeah. Let me see. Okay. Well, maybe let me finish this before we make a break. Okay, so I mean, let us try to understand the structure of this summation, this indices, for an example. So let me assume that, for example, gamma pi, maybe let me call it sigma as abbreviation. So this gives us, let's say, has a cycle structure 1, 3, 6, 4, 2, 5. So it's a permutation which sends 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 6, 6, 2, 1, 4 as a fixed point, 2 goes to 5, and 5 goes to 2. So, I mean, recall, I mean, pi has to be a pairing, but this doesn't mean that gamma pi is a pairing. Gamma pi can be something else. Okay. And so, in such a case, we would have here the summation. I would have P of J1. Okay, and then I have the J, but what is the index here? It's sigma of 1. Okay, so this is 3. So I have here J of 3. Then I have DJ2. I mean, the first one is just 1, 2, 3, and so on. But the second one is J at the image of 2 and a sigma, which is 5. Then I have J3 at and J of 6. DJ4, 4 goes to itself, so it's J4. D of J5, 5 goes to 2. And DJ6, 6 goes to 1. Okay, what I'm summing now over all J1 up to J6, but you see, I have here D, J1, J3, and J3 appears again here. Then I have here J6, D6 appears again here, and then the J1 exactly closes the cycle. So what I have here, the summation over J1, J3, and J6 gives me exactly the trace of the third power of D. I mean, the other guys have nothing to do. Then here, I have J4, J4, so what I have here is just a trace of D. And then I'm left with this, J2, J5, which fits here. So this is just a trace of D squared. Okay, and I mean, if I'm putting indices here, so if the Ds might even be different, then you see that I'm exactly taking the product according to the cycle structure here. So mainly what I have here, so it's a trace, so this here, so this is D1 times D3 times D6, which is exactly corresponds to the first cycle of sigma. Then I have the trace. Here I have the trace of D4, which is this cycle of sigma. And I have the trace of is this guy together with this y guy, D2 times D5, which is this cycle. So you see that you really get a product of traces. And what do we multiply the traces? We exactly multiply the elements which are at the positions which we have in the cycle of gamma pi. Okay, and I mean somehow it's of course clear that I mean something like this we denote by trace sub sigma of D1 up to D6. Oh, okay, in the usual way that if I have trace with some sub partition or permutation, I'm really understanding this as a product of traces corresponding to the cycle. Oh, okay, so it's a product of the corresponding traces. Good. Okay, of course, in our context, what we know is the convergence of the normalized traces. So I shouldn't look on the unnormalized traces, but I should convert this to the normalized traces. And of course, for each trace is 1 over n times normalized trace. So which means for each block of sigma, I get a factor 1 over n. So this here is the same as n to the number of blocks times sigma times the trace times the corresponding normalized trace. Yeah, okay, but then we have finally got as a result, that is following. So this expectation of the trace of D1, DQ1A up to DQMA is given by what? I'm summing over all pairings. Then I get a power of n. So what is this power? It's this, okay, first of all, number of blocks of our permutation sigma, but this is actually gamma times pi. Gamma pi shows up there. So it's the number of blocks of gamma times pi, and then I have 1 and m over 2, and I have to take this minus, so it's minus, because it's in the bottom, minus 1 minus m over 2, and I'm left, yeah, this whole guy there is nothing else than the trace, or it converges in the limit, let's see. It's just a trace of gamma pi d of q1 d of qm. Okay, just the product of normalized traces. Okay, but our normalized traces of d, powers of them converge to something by our assumption. So this guy converges to the corresponding limit object, and the question is just what happens with this guy here. Okay, but this is now exactly as we had in the first lecture. So namely this only converges if this guy here is zero, and okay, one has to convince oneself that it cannot be bigger than zero, so things cannot explode, and if it is equal to zero, this really means that this pi has to be non-crossing. So that was what Jamie talked about in the first lecture. So this guy here converges either to zero or one, and it converges to one exactly in the case if pi is non-crossing, and otherwise it goes to zero. That's really the point where I'm suppressing the crossing pairings. And that's the reason why in the limit, only the non-crossing ones survive. Okay. And of course, this guy, by our assumption, corresponds to the corresponding expression in the D's. Comma D of QM. Okay. Okay, so in this here meaning, of course, instead of summing over all pairings, I'm effectively only summing over the non-crossing ones. So what I really get here is the sum over the non-crossing pairings of m elements of phi of gamma pi d of q1 up to d of qm. Okay, so that's the result, and now of course it remains to compare this with the free situation. Okay, but maybe we make a break of, let's say, 5 minutes, so let's start again at 20 after, and then we will see what we have got here. So, okay, let's see what we have got. So we have calculated the mixed word in our constant matrices and the Gaussian random matrix in limit n goes to infinity. Okay, and we have got a formula which says we should sum over non-crossing pairings, and for each pairing we get a contribution which is somehow a product of moments in the d's. Okay, and I mean, of course, we would like to see that we have freeness in the limit, and so we should compare it with the formula which I showed you in the beginning. If you have two sets of free random variables and you multiply them, I mean, then you have to sum, I mean, here's still the formula, you have to sum over non-crossing pairings, and you have to take the moment of one of them and the cumulant of the others. One goes with the pairing, the other goes with the complement, and as I told you before, okay, if one of the sets is semicircular, it's actually quite a nice formula, and then we are very close to the structure of this. So namely, I mean, if we take, okay, the A's should be the D's, and the B's, okay, should be the A's, so the B's should be here semicirculars. So then this means, of course, that the cumulants of the B's are just the ones which only have second order cumulants, which means it effectively the summation over all partitions is reduced to the summation over non-crossing partitions. That's exactly what we have here. And then the question is only, what is the contribution of the other variables? I mean, here we have it given in terms of the complement, and here we have given it in terms of the permutation language. We have to multiply pi with gamma. Okay, and so of course we see that the formulas are the same, provided that this gamma pi really corresponds to the complement of pi. I mean, it's two different languages. One is more in a partition language, the other in a permutation language. But if those two things agree, then I mean we really have the same formula. Okay, and I mean they agree, and I want just to show this again by an example. So these formulas are the same. So we have to check that gamma of pi really corresponds to the complement, and we need the complement, the inverse of the complement here of pi. Okay, so to see this, let us take an example. So for pi, let us take, okay, what do I have here? This, maybe something which is not too simple. Okay, non-crossing pairing, like this, let's say. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, so if I'm writing this as a permutation, okay, so what is this? This is 1 goes to 10, 2 goes to 3, 4 goes to 7, 5 goes to 6, and 8 goes to 9, and back. Okay, so these are the transpositions corresponding to this, and now we should see that gamma times pi is the complement. So what is gamma pi? Okay, so gamma pi means first, okay, multiplication is first pi, then gamma. So what happens? So 1 goes to 10 under gamma, and then it goes to 1 again, so this means 1 is a fixed point. Then 2 goes to 3, and 3 goes to 4. I mean, gamma is just shifting it by 1. It goes to 4. So 4 goes to 7, 7 goes to 8. 8 goes to 9, 9 goes to 10. 10 goes to, under pi goes to 1. And, let me see. 1 goes to 2. Ah, yeah, we started with 2. Okay, good. That's exactly what I wanted. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So 2, 4, 8, 10. Then what still do we have? 3. What happens to 3? 3 goes to 2. Okay, but 2 goes to 3 again, so it's also fixed. Then 5. 5 goes to 6. 6 goes to 7. 7 goes to 4. This goes to 5, so it closes it again. Then 6 goes to 5. This goes to 6. And 9. 9 goes to 8, 15 times goes to 9. Okay, so that's gamma pi. And now the question is, what is the complement? So we have to take the complement in the other direction, which means we should not put the additional points after it, but before. So we should look on the partition, which I have at this point. Okay, so here, I mean, these are now the new 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, what can I do? I mean, here I cannot connect anything. Here I can connect this guy, and this stays on its own. Is there anything left? So what do I have? I have 1. 1 is a block on itself. Then I have 2, 4, 8, 10. So 2, 4, 8, 10. 3 stays alone. Okay, then I have those two here. I can connect. So 5 and 7 is a block. And 6, 9, and 3 are just singletons. Okay, so you see at least in this example that actually the inverse of the complement of my pairing, of my pi, really corresponds to gamma pi. Okay, and this is true in general. So this really means that those two formulas are the same. I mean, this is more general formula, but if I specify to the case where the b's are semicirculars, it's exactly the same formula. So we see in a limit for our random matrices, if I calculate moments in D and A, I really get the formula for calculating mixed moments in arbitrary A and the semicircular element. So I have all mixed moments of D and A, so this really tells me that A goes to semicircle, D goes to something which I have specified, but the important point is that D and A are going to something which is free in a limit. Good, so let's write this down. It's a theorem, which you just have seen, and of course, I mean, we can generalize this. Instead of 1A, I can take more of them. Instead of, 1D, I could put indices there. So let me formulate it in a little bit more general way. So I have, let's say, P, Gaussian random matrices, A and P. This should be P independent Gaussian random matrices. And in addition, I have my constant matrices, but we would have also considered Q of them. Bn1 up to Bnq, so this should be Q constant. What we call a constant, really, it is not constant in N or whatever, it's really constant in a probability frame, so it's actually non-random, might be a better word. Okay, so it's constant or non-random matrices, of which we assume that they have a limit distribution. So we assume that Dn1 up to Dnq converge to some limit element, D1 up to Dq. And this just means that all traces in mixed moments have a limit, converge to a limit. Okay, and then we just say this limit is the same as the corresponding phi of the corresponding word. Okay, and then what is our statement? Then the statement is, if I consider all these matrices together, so the A's, the Gaussian random matrices, together with the D's, the constant matrices, then this converges. Of course, each of them converges. The D's converge to these little D's, and of course the A's we know converge to semicirculars, but the point is that we can make a statement about the relation between those guys. So it converges to S1 up to SP, D1 up to DQ, where, of course, those are semicirculars. These are the distributions which we had before, but the main statement is now that the D's are free from the S's, and actually also the S's are free among themselves, because we know independent Gaussians go to free variables. So what we have here is that each SI is a semicircle, and S1 up to SP, and the set given by D's, D1 up to DQ, are free. Okay. Of course, the D's among themselves are not free, because this is something which I have chosen from the beginning. Okay, I'm only saying that the D's together are free from the S's. Okay, and in particular, of course, we can say this means asymptotically, those constant matrices are asymptotically free from the Gaussian random matrices. Okay, so we have asymptotic freeness now, not only among Gaussian random matrices, but we can include constant matrices in this frame. And this is really an important observation for operator algebraic applications, and next week, so Jimmy will really talk about how this can be used to get some information about the free group vectors. Good. Okay, but today I want to talk a little bit more about this, so I want to present, more general results in this direction. So this is one step, but they are more general ones, and in particular there are results where you can replace the Gaussian random matrices by high unitary matrices, by unitary random matrices. So that's the next step. I only want to give you the result. I'm not going to prove the things. It's somehow in the same spirit as before, a little bit more complicated, but more or less the same kind of calculation. So I just want to give you maybe kind of idea and the result. So asymptotic freeness between high unitary random matrices and again constant matrices. Good. Okay, so what, first of all, what do I mean with high unitary random matrices? I think we haven't talked about those. It's I could put a probability measure on the set of unitary matrices, and the unitary matrices, I mean, this is quite nice, I mean, the unitary matrices form a compact group, and by M matrices, so I have a canonical Haar measure around, which I can normalize to be a probability measure. Okay, so U of M are the unitary M by M matrices. So this is a compact group, and this means I have a unique Haar measure there, which can be normalized to be a probability measure. Okay, so this gives me Haar measure, which is determined by the fact that, yeah, that it's invariant under multiplication in the group. And so I normalize this to be a probability measure. And this gives me, and if I'm looking, yeah, if I'm taking a unitary matrix, then under this probability measure, that's what I'm calling a high unitary random matrix. Okay, so this gives me a high unitary random matrix. Okay, and now of course one can ask questions about these random matrices. First of all, maybe the simplest question is what is somehow the analog of Wigner's theorem, so namely what is the distribution of such a high unitary random matrix, but that's actually quite simple. So let UN be high unitary random matrix. Okay, and of course I mean the state which I consider is again taking expectation and traces of powers. Oh, okay, expectation with respect to this Haar measure, and so what does it, yeah, what is the distribution of this guy? Of course, I would like, so what I have to understand are moments in U. But because U is not normal, I should consider moments in U and U star to capture the essential information. But because it's unitary, of course, U times U star is the identity. So if I have some U's and some of U stars, I mean, they will cancel each other. And I mean, I can cancel it until only powers of U or powers of U star survive. So the only information which I need about the distribution is to know what are the moments of U and of what powers of U and powers of U star. Okay, so since UN star UN and UN UN star is the identity as a unitary operator, the star distribution of UN is determined by the knowledge of phi of UN to some power and UN star to some power for all m in n. Of course, if the power is 0, then of course it's phi of 1, and phi of 1 is always 1. Good. Okay, so what is this? But this is actually quite simple, because I know that my unitary matrices, that my distribution, has to stay invariant if I multiply things with a unitary one, in a unitary matrix, because I mean that's a property of the Haar measure. Okay, so this means I can multiply my high unitary matrix with a number of modulus 1. This gives me just another high unitary matrix, but of course this must have the same distribution. So this means if I multiply my U with something of modulus 1, then I shouldn't change the corresponding moment. So if I have lambda of phi, which has absolute value 1, then UN, and UN is a high unitary matrix, then lambda times UN is again high unitary random matrix, which means its moment must be the same as before without multiplying. So this means that phi of lambda UN to the power m must be the same as phi before multiplication with lambda UN to the power m. Okay, but of course, I mean, this multiplication here has the effect of lambda to the m times phi of un to the m. Okay, so this means this moment must be a number which, if multiplied, is the nth power of any of any module with one number is the same, and I mean, this means, of course, it must be zero. Okay, so this means that phi of un to some power is equal to zero, and of course the same for the star. Okay, so all those moments are actually equal to zero, and I mean, such a distribution, such these elements are quite important in free probability theory, so we are giving a special name to them, and I mean, we are calling them high unitary. This is clear, I mean, where this comes from. Okay, so whenever I have an element, a unitary element, whose distribution is determined this way, we are calling it a high unitary element. And so what I calculated here is saying that our high unitary random matrices are actually high unitary elements. And actually for each n, I don't have the need to go to a limit here. And I mean, in a sense, this is the analog of Wigner's theorem, but it's trivial here. It's not really anything deep. Okay, but it's, at least it motivates the definition of a high unitary element. So A phi should be a non-commutative probability space in our abstract setting. So A is a unitary algebra, and I mean it should be a star algebra, because if I want to talk about unitary elements, I should have a star. Phi is a linear function algebra, and so A should be a star algebra. And then we call an element U in A high unitary if it is unitary, and in addition its distribution is of the form that u to the power k is equal to 0 for all k integer numbers with the exception of 0. For 0, of course, it has to be equal to 1. But otherwise, for positive and negative powers, which are just the powers of the star, it has to be 0. Okay, and so this is just a definition, but it's an important element. So what I have shown you before is that high unitary n times n random matrices, a high unitary n times n random matrix is a high unitary element in this sense. Okay, and this is true for each n. No need to take a limit. Good. Okay, so that's simple observation. But now, I mean, I'm again, as before, I'm interested in the behavior of these unitary random matrices with respect to constant matrices. I also want to include constant matrices and ask, is it true that I have the same kind of statement if I replace the Gaussian elements, the Gaussian random variables, by unitary random matrices? And that is actually the case. And to prove this, I mean, there are various possibilities. The one which Voiculescu did when he first showed this was essentially to reduce the high unitary case to the Gaussian case, essentially by making polar decomposition. Because if you make a polar decomposition of a Gaussian random variable without symmetry assumptions, then the polar part is a high unitary random variable like this. Okay, I mean, maybe a cleaner and more direct way is to imitate what we did before, namely just to try to write down the traces of power of mixed words in your unitary element and some constant matrices in terms of the entries and see what you get. But of course this means you have to understand the joint distribution of the entries of a unitary random matrix. And this is a priori not so clear. I mean, the Gaussian random variables are defined essentially by saying what is the joint distribution of the entries. In the unitary case, it's not clear. You're not saying anything about the distribution of the entries. You just say the matrix itself has special properties and how invariance properties underdoing rotations. But these invariance properties are actually enough to determine the joint distribution of the entries. But it's not so simple anymore. In particular, of course, they are not independent. Okay, but I mean, you can... One can deal with this, and there's actually some kind of nice formula, which is the replacement of the Wick formula in the Gauss case, which I just want to write down. I mean, this is somehow the starting point of the calculation. If you have this formula, it's more or less doing the same as we did before. It's a little bit more complicated, but it's somehow the same kind of calculation. Okay, and this replacement is, so you have the following kind of Wick formula, the expectation of a product of, let's say, k1 l1 up to u kn ln, and then u bar
I1 J1 up to U bar IN JN. So you take a product of entries of your matrix with arbitrary indices, so, and you take a product of U's and a product of U bars. And I mean, it's easy to see that you must have the same number of U and U bars, again by the same kind of multiplication with lumber. Otherwise, it's zero, such an expression. So the only non-trivial ones were where you have the same number of U and U stars, and then you have a formula, which we are calling type of Weingarten type of formula, because I mean such things were considered by Weingarten maybe in the 60s or 70s, and they were revived somehow in the context of free probability. So I think the essential things going back to Weingarten. Okay, so this formula tells that what you should do is you sum over permutations alpha and beta, and again you must somehow you sum over possibilities how the indices fit together. So you should check that the indices that indices appearing at the K at the U must also appear at the U bar, and you must have a matching between those guys. Okay, so we have a delta of I1, so the index I1 must appear also as a K at some other position. Okay, and I mean that's the effect of this alpha. Up to delta of IN K of alpha N. And then the same with the second index, the J's must appear again as the L's, L of beta of 1 up to delta of JN, which must be the same as some L at some position beta of N. Okay, so you're summing over all possibilities, so if you have an alpha and a beta such that the indices match, then you will get a contribution. But this contribution is not easy. I mean, it will of course somehow depend on the data, and I mean we just call this contribution, it's a function depending on some thing that we call it a Weingarten function, so of course it depends on n, and it depends on beta times alpha to the minus 1. Okay, actually it only depends on the conjugation class, I think, of this guy. Okay, so that's here what we call the Weingarten function. Okay, and of course I mean to go further with this, one needs some information about this. But actually what one really needs is the asymptotic order, the leading order in N. Because that's only the thing which survives in the limit in my calculation. And one knows that the leading order of this Weingarten function in N and pi, this is like N, 1 over N to the power 2N minus the number of blocks in pi. So pi is an element here in Sn. Good, okay. Yeah. And I mean, actually one doesn't even need to know what the coefficient here is to show asymptotic freeness. Okay, I mean to show this leading order, that's not too hard. I mean the Weingarten function, if you want to understand it in full, it's a quite complicated object. Just for the leading order, it's okay. I mean it's not obvious now, but I mean one can get this without too much effort. Okay, and I mean if you have this information, then you can model and you can just write down what is the trade of some products in U's and D's. You write it down in coefficients. You apply this delta will give you some things. I mean the leading order will suppress all the crossing things in the end, and you will end up with a formula which contains just the summation over non-crossing guys. And then you just see again that this is the same formula which you get in a corresponding free situation. Good. Okay, but I don't want to do this. I mean, it's similar to what we did before, but it will take probably another hour. So I guess let me just write down the final statement that we again have asymptotic freeness between high unitary random matrices and constant matrices. So we have the same result as we had before, but we can replace the Gaussian random matrices by high unitaries. Okay, so let UN 1, again we can take several of them, so we take P independent high unitary random matrices, and in addition we have constant matrices DN 1 up to DN Q. This should be Q constant matrices, of which we assume that they have a limit distribution, so dn1 up to dnq converge to something in the limit, meaning that all traces of powers of them have a limit. And then the statement is that then the U's and the D's together can be described very nicely in the limit, and we have in particular asymptotic freeness. So Un1, Unp, and Dn1 up to Dnq converge. Okay, the U's, I mean, of course, they converge to high unit terms. I mean, they're actually high unit terms, but point is, again, they're also getting asymptotically free. Also, the limit, also independent half unitary random matrices becoming free, and they are becoming free from the D's. So, D1 up to DQ, where each UI is a high unitary element, and the U's are free, and they are free from the D's. And in this case, I mean, we should actually say they are star-free, which means I can also include the U and the U star. Can calculate mixed words in U and U star. Okay, to put it another way, I mean, the U's and the D's are becoming asymptotically star-free. Okay, good. And let me make one more comment in this direction. I mean, all these theorems look a little bit special. They seem to say, okay, we have asymptotic freeness between somehow, okay, the D's can be very general. I mean, okay, we can prescribe more or less whatever we want. But the other guys are very special. I mean, here they are Gauss or Gaussian random matrices, so the limit there, they are semicirculars. And here in the limit, we have high unitaries. So it seems we have found freeness in the random matrix world, but somehow only between special elements. At least one of them must be a very special one. Okay, but somehow it would be nicer to really be able to realize any two given distributions in a free way by random matrices, asymptotically. Yeah, but, this one here actually is strong enough to do this, if one makes the following observation, namely, if I have a free high unitary, then I can use it to make things free by rotating with it. So let me write this down as a proposition, because it shows that this theorem is actually much in a sense, it's much stronger than it appears, because it really allows you to realize arbitrary distributions in random matrices such that they are free. Okay, so this is the following quite simple observation. So if U is high unitary and it is star free from, let's say, A and B, that's somehow the situation which we can realize here. Well, in a limit, we have high unitaries which are free from a set of elements. But of course, in the set of elements, A and B are not necessarily free. But now we can use the U to make them essentially free. So namely, we can look on A and U, B, U star. So we are rotating essentially the B by the U, and then they are free. Okay, so why is this? I mean, this is actually quite simple. You prove it just by going back to the definition of freeness. So namely, what do we have to prove? So we want to show those guys are free, so we should take alternating words in them, which are centered, and we should see that phi on the product is zero. Well, that was just the definition. So we should consider phi of a word, and I mean a word in A is just a polynomial in A. So we should take P1 of A, then we should take a polynomial in the other guy, which is Q1 of U, B, U star, a polynomial in A, a polynomial in U, B, U star, finite product of them, and we should see that this is zero if we assume that phi on each of them is zero. So we consider the situation that phi of pi of A is equal to zero, and phi of the qi of u, b, u star is equal to zero. Okay, good. I mean, what we know is something, if we have alternating words in U's, and something from this set. Okay, so, to prove this, we should somehow see that this can also be read as an alternating word in the U and the A's and the B's, which fulfills the corresponding assumption. And the main point for this is just that you realize that a polynomial in U, B, U star is actually the same polynomial in B conjugated by U. So if I have a polynomial in U, B, U star, so what is this? I have a linear combination of powers of them, but if I have powers of them, all the U and U stars in the middle, they cancel each other. The only thing which remains is a U at the beginning and a U star at the end, and I get the same polynomial in the middle. So this is the same as U times Q of B, U star. Okay, so in particular, this means that my assumption here can be read, this is the phi, so this here is the same as Q, U of QI of B, U star. Okay, but U and B are free, which means phi of such a thing is phi of the middle thing times phi of U, U star. So this is phi of QI of B times phi of U, U star. So this is one, this disappears, so actually this assumption can also be read in a way that the QI of B are zero under phi. Okay, but then this guy here is then, this is the same as P1 of A, then the Q1, this is U times Q1 B U star, then we have a P2 of A, then we have a U Q2 of B U star, and so on. But now we just read this in a way, that we have alternating guys in the U and something from the A's and the B's. So we have something from the A's and the B's, then we have a U, something from the A's and the B's, then we have a U, and so on. And finally, each of them is zero. Because, phi on this guy, according to assumption, phi on this guy, with this observation, according to our assumption, and phi on U and phi on U star are zero anyhow, because it's an high unitary element. So we are exactly here in a situation where I have a word for which the freeness of the U from the A and B implies that this word is zero, that phi on this word is zero. So this is zero. But that's actually what we have to show for the freeness of A from U, B, U star. Good. Okay. So this means then, in terms of random matrices, that if I take the U which I get here to make a random rotation, then I really can realize free distributions for any given distribution. Okay, so let me write this down here. Theorem. So let us consider AN and BN be two sequences of constant non-random N times N matrices such that each of them has a limit distribution. So AN converges to some A, and BN converges to some B. And I have total freedom. Whenever you give me a given distribution, I can construct a random matrix or which converges to this distribution. No? Okay, so you really can realize any given distribution with random matrices. Okay, but we want to realize both of them in such a way that they are free. And what I told you before is that if I take in addition UN, a high unitary N times N random matrix, then we know that UN becomes asymptotically free in the limit from those guys. But then by this observation I can use this UN to make also those two guys free from each other. Because then I should consider AN and the rotation of the BN. So UN, BN, UN star converges now to what? This goes to A. And of course the distribution of the BN is not changed by this conjugation. I'm not changing the distribution of the B. I'm just changing the relation between these two guys. So this goes to B, but in addition, A and B are now free. Okay, so to put it another way, those guys are becoming asymptotically free. The effect of this conjugation by U, it's a kind of random rotation, but the effect is that when I started, I might have very definite relations between the eigenspaces of A and B. They are not free. Okay, but now I rotate the eigenspaces in a random way. I'm destroying all correlation between them. So I've brought them into a generic position, and then they are really actually free in the limit. So for random matrices, you get asymptotic freeness typically in a situation where you have the eigenspaces sitting in a generic position. Okay, so random matrices are asymptotically free if the eigenspaces are in a generic position. Good, but this, and maybe in the end I wanted to show some pictures, if I get this in here working again. Of course this relation with random matrices, can be used in two ways. First of all, freeness was invented for operator algebras, and the relation with random matrices allows to use random matrix ideas to prove something about operator algebras. That's what Jamie will show you next time, how these things are important for this one. But we can also go the other way around. Maybe this one. We have now seen that random matrices are becoming asymptotically free, and we have actually developed a kind of machinery with the R-transform and the cumulants for dealing with, for example, the sum of free random variables. So this means we can use this machinery for calculating the distributions of special random matrices, which are more complicated than just Gauss or Wishart. Everybody knows the limit of Gaussian and Wishart random matrices. Of course, that's not the point of free probability theory, but it allows you to deal with much more complicated situations. So in particular, I showed you that the R-transform machinery allows you to deal with the sum of random matrices. And I hope we get also some pictures. So that's what we had before. Oh yeah, Machenko, Pasteur. Okay, but now, so let me just recall this to see the relevance for this. I talked in the 2 weeks ago or so about this, how you can translate this relation between moments and cumulants into power series, huh? So into the relation between the Cauchy transform and the R transform, and that's the main relation which allows you to calculate one if you know the other. Maybe it's not so easy, but it can be done. It can be done on a computer. Huh? You might end up with algebraic equations which are higher than order 4, but there's no problem of numerical solving them. Okay, and then one has this theorem that on the level of the R transform, things are very simple. The cumulants are additive, or the R transform is additive. So adding up things on the level of the R transform is simple, which means if you have two free things which you would like to add, for example, random matrices which are asymptotically free, then you should first calculate the Cauchy transform for each of them. On the level of the Cauchy transform, things are not so easy. So we should go over to the R transform, right? We have this relation between G and R, so we can calculate the R transform for each of them, and then we just add them up to get the R transform for the sum, and then we should go back again by the same relation between G and R to the Cauchy transform, and then you can use Dieterich's inversion formula for really get the distribution of A plus B. Okay, and so, in the spirit of what I just have done, you might consider this for the case where we really take now random matrices of the form A plus UB star. Let us look at the situation where both A and B have just a Bernoulli distribution. So let's say half of the eigenvalues are zero, and the other half is just, in this case, one half. Okay, so they just have two distributions, so I take two. So I take a random matrix, you can just take a diagonal one. Diagonal matrices, the first half on the diagonal is zero, the second half is just one half. Okay, you send n to infinity, you take two of them, of course they're not free, they commute. Okay, but now you take a high unitary, which means you rotate the second one in a random way, and of course it's still a matrix which has half of the eigenvalue zero, the other half one half, but it's now that compared to my basis for the first one, the eigenspace is randomly rotated. Okay, and then what I have just shown you, those guys are asymptotically free, so this means if I want to calculate the eigenvalue distribution of the sum, I can just use the R transform. So I should calculate the eigenvalue distribution of the sum of two free elements, each of which has this Bernoulli as its eigenvalue distribution. Okay, I don't have enough time. I mean, otherwise I could have done this calculation how you do it. I mean, this is really a situation where you can do the calculation, go through all those steps, and what you get there is, I mean, maybe a bit surprising, you get a continuous distribution. I mean, a classical situation, if you take the convolution of atomic things, you get just atoms. I mean, if you take two Bernoullis with two atoms, you just get a Bernoulli with three atoms, huh, and so on. But here you get something which is continuous, and it's actually an arcsine distribution. So you can calculate this explicitly. And I mean, if you do this for random matrices, I mean, the distribution is this red graph here. Okay, and now you can realize this with random matrices. So again, you can do this in the average sense, or you can do it in the almost pure sense. Yeah, in this almost pure sense, I have taken two matrices, 2048 times 2048, so which means 1024 cells, 1024 one half, and another matrix like this, and then I have produced one unitary matrix which I have used to rotate the second one. I have added them up and I have calculated 2048 eigenvalues, and I have plotted the histogram. Oh, and you see it's even in this almost pure in this one realization, it's quite close to the red curve, which is the result which free probability predicts. Okay, and if you average, here I have averaged over 64 by 64 matrices, but I have averaged 5,000 times. So I have here 5,000 times 64 eigenvalues. Okay, and then of course the agreement is even better. Okay, maybe another thing which you can consider is you can take Wigner and Wishart matrices, and because those matrices are invariant under rotations, what we have just seen applies to them, and they are asymptotically free. So the eigenspaces are in generic position. So this means if you, for example, want to calculate the eigenvalue distribution of the sum of a Wigner and a Wishart matrix, this is given in terms of free probability by the sum of a semicircle and a Matschenko-Pastur distribution, which are free. And again, I mean, you can write down the equations. You cannot solve it algebraically, I think. Well, maybe it's a third order equation or something like this, but you can do it numerically. And I mean, here first of all, I have shown again somehow, I have taken the sum of Wigner and Wishart, and I'm showing again that it's almost pure convergence. Which means that if I do one realization in each of them, I always seem to converge to the same deterministic curve in the limit. Okay, and I mean, the red curve is what free probability predicts, the sum of a semicircle plus a Matschenko-Pastur, which you can calculate by using the R transform. Okay, or here it's for another value of the parameters. Okay, then I mean, you can also talk about the product of variables. So you can also take the product of two random matrices and ask, can I also deal with them? And there's also analogous to the R transform, we also have in free probability something which is called the S transform, which allows to deal with this. So I mean, I have shown you somehow the combinatorial description, how you calculate moments of A times B in combinatorial terms. And somehow in a similar way, as you could translate for the sum in terms of the R transform, you can also translate this combinatorial description into a description with power series. But it's more complicated in this case, but it still can be done purely combinatorially. It's again a translation of this combinatorial description into power series. Okay, so you have something like this, so you get some function which is the inverse of some generating power series, and if you have three variables, then the S-transform of their product is just the product of the S-transforms. So it's similar as for the R-transform, and so this allows you really to calculate distributions of products. And so, I mean, what you can do, for example, you can take two independent Wishart matrices. They are asymptotically free. So, I mean, their product should be given by the product of two free Matschenko-Pastur distributions. And, I mean, here's one possibility for doing this. So, again, I have... It's in the average sense, in an almost sure sense, the red curve is what free probability gives you. Okay, and I think... Yeah, I think that's it. Okay. Okay, so I hope, I mean... I just wanted to show you that, I mean, free probability is, on one side, it's quite abstract, coming from operator algebra. Okay, it's nice combinatorics, but it has also very concrete meaning for random matrices. So, I mean, you really can add and multiply random matrices, and, I mean, really what you get there is really predicted by free probability. And the accuracy the matching between the red curve from free probability and the histogram is usually quite good. So, okay, so that's it for today.